think I see more right answers than I've been seeing. So, do I have them all? So constellation A was... There were lots of them right. You're just not sure about them, huh? Sorry to have it kind of double exposed. So this is Aquila with bright star Altair. It's one of the summer triangle stars. This guy here, constellation B. I'm going to be shy today. So this has bright star Arcturus in it. The kind of ditty is that you kind of follow the arc of the Big Dipper handle to get to that star Arcturus, which is Bootes, spelled kind of like booties. This guy here with no particular bright stars and no particular shape, at least in my opinion, is, say again?
Perseus.
And this guy here with no bright stars, it has a definite shape. It's got this keystone in there. Hercules. Okay, so there's been some discussion about, you know, that the old tests are online and all that sort of stuff, but there have been some questions as to exactly where they are. So let's kind of follow it through. So here's our usual homepage, and these are the two relevant exams, the one from last year in this class and the one from the other year in this class. When the lights come on, you can see here are the list of questions that are out from those exams. That is to say, we don't cover exactly the same thing. And in particular, we're several lectures behind in the previous class. So actually, there's a better match with the 211 exam than there is with the 212 exam. So if you're only going to work one, my recommendation would be to do the 212 ones. So how do you find those online solutions? So you go to lectures, and then if you're looking at 212, these are all of the lectures and pretty much everything that's here. And the ones we want are the ones that are listed as, oops, so we want to go to last year. So we're talking about these exams here that are T2. This is the true and false. This is the short answer. This is the long answer questions. And similarly, if we're interested in the 211 exam, then you click on 211, and it's the ones that are T2. Oops. Not sure I can highlight it nicely. So those are the T2 screencasts for solutions for the 211 exam. Yes?
You say that one of the test?
Yeah, so you probably can't read the numbers here, but when I turn on the lights, I think you can. So these are the numbers of the questions that are out, that are not, will not, no question like that will be on your exam. And the reason is that here the sun was covered way more extensively than we're going to cover it. And this is a slightly different class, so it's starting to talk about planets, which are not relevant to us. And again, if you really want to, you can listen to it all again, right? So these are all of our lectures. It's maybe a little bit helpful to remember the code to sort it by date. So these are the most recent things that we've been talking about, starting at conservation laws. And you notice that there's a screencast that has solutions to the light quiz questions on it. Okay, and I think the best way to study for the exam is to actually work one of those exams or both of those exams and come in and have me kind of graded in front of you. Haven't been a lot of takers on that. But I think it's a good way. We've got a help session tonight at 8:00 here. Any questions on anything? Yeah, help session will be here. Okay, so mostly last time we were taking the big quiz, and which you should have your graded stuff for, and we were doing kind of a hands-on thing with lenses. And in terms of the lenses, the thing to remember is there are three numbers that we use to describe these lenses. We've got the diameter of the lens goes by the name aperture. We've got the focal length of the lens. That's, remember, you the distance between the lens and the focused image. So typically you moved your lens up and down on the table until you got a focused image of the lights. And the F number, which you have to calculate, it's the ratio of the focal length to the aperture. Yes?
On Newtonian telescopes, is the focal length the mirror divided plus the one there? Or what?
So the focal length for a telescope is always the distance from the objective, typically mirror for us, to the eyepiece. So the mirror is here at the bottom. So, and the eyepiece is there, so the focal length would be that pretty much total distance. Now, the focal length actually has to be a little bit in front of the eyepiece, but not much in front of the eyepiece.
So it would just be that part, not the
focal. So it would be this whole distance, about 2 meters, in order to get to that eyepiece. For this Cassegrain, the focal length, it bounces off of this mirror, goes to the top, and bounces back. So it would be, roughly speaking, twice this distance. And for the CUDA focus, it's going to be long because it's a long way to where the light's coming to a focus, but there's no way of drawing it. And for prime, then it's obvious, right? More questions? So since these three things are related, you almost never see all three of them specified. So for telescopes, most commonly what they'll tell you is the aperture and the F number. And that was the case for the problem that was at the bottom of the hands-on thing that probably only 20% of you worked on. And the key thing for that problem is that you can always calculate the F number by taking the aperture, or excuse me, you can calculate the focal length by taking the aperture times the F number. And once you've got the focal length, then you're all set to calculate the magnification because it's the ratio of the focal length of the objective divided by the focal length of the eyepiece. And remember that one of the reasons that magnification is not a particularly important property is that it's easily changed, right? You just put in a different eyepiece and you can get a different magnification. Okay. So in an ideal world, if we didn't have to worry about the atmosphere, then the resolution of a telescope would depend on the ratio of the wavelength of light you're talking about to the diameter of the telescope. Now, it's not true for optical telescopes that are at the surface of the Earth because the atmosphere is an ocean of air. It's got waves in it. So the images are always being shifted around by those waves. And so the resolution of an optical telescope is dependent upon atmospheric seeing. And so if we want to improve the resolution of a ground-based telescope, we want to get it above as much of the atmosphere as possible. If we have a really small telescope, like your eye, right, it has an aperture that's just a few millimeters, then this formula is relevant. The atmosphere is not limiting it under those circumstances. Or if we're talking about a radio telescope, because it turns out radio light is refracted a whole lot less by the atmosphere than visible light is, then we've got the same sort of formula. And in terms of radio telescopes, that's a problem. Because we've increased the wavelength by a factor of a million, going from millionths of meters to meter-sized waves, and we've increased the diameter by a lot, maybe a factor of 10, but not a factor of a million. So a priori, a radio telescope is going to have a much worse resolution. It's going to produce fuzzier images than an optical telescope is. And the solution to that is interferometry. We can put together lots of individual radio telescope dishes in order to simulate a single big dish. And people are in the business of trying to do the same thing with optical wavelengths, but it just turns out it's a lot harder to deal with optical stuff than it is with radio stuff. It turns out that how you mount your telescope is probably as expensive as the telescope itself. There are two kind of standard ways of doing it. The way we do it in lab is with an equatorial mount, where one joint points at the North Star and rotates at one revolution per day, so it's going to keep up with the celestial sphere. The other way of doing it is to have two joints, one that turns with azimuth and one that turns with altitude. Those angles have to always change, kind of not in a regular fashion, in order to follow a rising and setting star. So if you're going to have a tracking alt-azimuth mount telescope, you need to have a computer to control those two joints. So both the most expensive telescopes and the least expensive telescopes have alt-azimuth. So all of the new big 10-meter class telescopes have alt-azimuths just because of the mechanical advantages of having the weight kind of rationally arranged, as opposed to having this axle that's sticking at a 45-degree angle, which turns out to be mechanically more difficult. Questions? Okay, so the last topic before the second exam is dealing with the sun, and we've got kind of two big questions that I want to talk about today. And the main one is why the sun doesn't explode, which may seem like kind of a funny question, but turns out it's not at all obvious why the sun doesn't explode. But before we can talk about why the sun doesn't explode, we really need to talk about what powers the sun. What are the reactions that power the sun? So you know, of course, that the sun is powered by some sort of nuclear reactions. And it's important to recognize that there isn't anything fundamentally different between nuclear reactions and chemical reactions. In both cases, the idea is that the parts that make up the thing are going to rearrange each other to have a lower energy, and then the missing energy can come off in the form of heat and light. So if we're burning wood, for example, we're going from an arrangement of the carbon and oxygen atoms that has a high energy to an arrangement of the carbon and oxygen atoms that has a lower energy, and the difference in energy we can give off is light. So it's going to be the same story with nuclear reactions. We're going to have a rearrangement of the components simply to produce a lower energy state. And in fact, the system is actually simpler than it is in terms of chemistry. If I were to draw the chemical structure of TNT, it wouldn't be particularly obvious that that's a high energy state and that the products of those reactions are low energy molecules, right? It's simply not particularly clear, but it is for nuclear reactions. You can pretty concisely show what's a high energy nuclei and what's a low energy nuclei. And the answer goes under the name of the bend in the binding energy curve. And this is simply a plot of basically the size of the nucleus. That is to say, how far down the periodic table you have to go until you get to the nucleus. That's the number of nucleons versus the energy. And it turns out that this has a fairly simple shape that looks kind of like that. So the upshot is that the lowest energy nuclei turns out to be a type of iron, iron 56. And so we can release energy if we take a big nucleus and break it apart, or we can go to a low energy state if we take a small nucleus and put them together. Both of those things work. So taking a big nucleus like uranium and breaking apart, that's called fission. So that's what was behind the original so-called atomic bombs, the nuclear bombs that were used on Japan. They took uranium and plutonium and broke them apart into two pieces and went to a more stable nucleus, and the energy that was given off in the form of heat and light. We can also do the same thing at the other end. We can take small nuclei and put them together. This is called fusion. And that's how the sun works and how hydrogen bombs work, for that matter. So we take relatively small nuclei like hydrogen and we build them up into more complicated nuclei. So the net reaction for the sun is that four normal sorts of hydrogens, so hydrogen as in a hydrogen balloon, four of those things get together and they're going to form helium. So we've just gone one step on the periodic table, right? We've gone from hydrogen to helium. And if you just count your nuclei, normal hydrogen has a proton in it, and normal helium has two protons and two neutrons in it. So it must be, just counting things up, that two of these protons have become neutrons. And if that's going to happen, they have to release an antimatter electron and a neutrino. antimatter electron is called a positron. And, you know, if you've watched any Star Trek, you know antimatter is kind of nasty stuff. So very quickly, that antimatter electron will find an electron partner, and those two will end up annihilated also. So we'll end up then with just hydrogen, with hydrogen becoming helium, and a couple of neutrinos, and a lot of energy being released. Now, the exact sequence of reactions that go on is more complicated, and I do want you to understand it. And in particular, having four things come together at the same time is pretty unlikely. So this is not the way the reaction actually runs. So it actually runs as a sequence of steps. And basically, automatically, the only possibility for the first step is that two hydrogens get together. So this is what's called the hydrogen-hydrogen chain. And the first starting point is that two protons come together, and while they're close together, one of those protons becomes a neutron, and the neutron sticks to the proton, and in the process of that, the antimatter electron is given off and a neutrino. And as I say, very quickly, the antimatter electron will combine with a normal electron, and they will mutually annihilate to release light also. Okay, and it turns out that this is not a likely reaction to have happen, right? You don't worry about the hydrogen in your balloon spontaneously turning into deuterium. It's very unlikely to occur. So on average, it takes 14 billion years for this to happen to a typical proton inside the sun. Almost always what happens when two protons collide is absolutely nothing. They just bounce off each other. It's a very rare interaction that has a proton turning into a neutron. And the reason a neutron is turning into a proton is because of the weak force. Remember, we talked about that the weak force is usually represented as a transformation sort of force, and it's called the weak force for good reason, that almost always nothing happens. Only very occasionally does a hydrogen turn into a neutron. But there are zillions of protons that are running into each other every day inside the sun, so it's while it's an unlikely reaction, it is one that is constantly going on. The next reaction you can see happens pretty quick, right? On average, 6 seconds. And that happens where deuterium, this thing is deuterium, runs into a proton, and what happens is the proton sticks, so we end up with a nucleus that has two protons and one neutron. You remember that the name of the element just depends on the number of protons. So if we just got one proton, it's hydrogen. If we've got two protons, it's helium. So this has two protons and hence is helium. And there are three things inside the nucleus, so this is called helium-3. It turns out there are lots of ways we can complete the reaction. The most common way is for two helium-3s to get together, and we get kind of a whole rearrangement. So here's one helium-3, and here's another helium-3, and these things are going to come together to make garden variety helium, which has two protons and two neutrons. And if you just work through the numbers, two protons have to be released in this process. Okay, so net-net, what's happening inside the sun is hydrogen is becoming helium. But it doesn't happen in one step. And the step that is the rate limiting step is this step here, where two protons get together to form deuterium. It's pretty unlikely for that to occur, even though zillions of protons are colliding with protons every second inside the sun. Only relatively rarely do they stick together to form deuterium. But once they form deuterium, then it's pretty much bing bang, and we end up with helium-4. Okay. So the sun and most things in the universe are mostly made out of hydrogen and helium. Roughly speaking, with hydrogen being 75% by weight, and helium being say 25% by weight. So there's lots of hydrogen to burn inside the sun. Okay, questions? And that's, of course, just the first step that we can go through for fusion, right? Because we have, it's a long way to iron 56. All we've done is start with the simplest thing, which is protons, and gotten to kind of the next simplest thing, which is helium, right? So in terms of the periodic table, we've just gone from here to there, but iron is pretty well down the list. Questions? So it's fusion that powers the sun, thermonuclear fusion, just like happens in hydrogen bombs, pretty much like that, what happens in hydrogen bombs. The reason that high temperatures are required is, of course, that the two protons don't like to get together, right? The same charges are going to repel. So you have to throw them together pretty hard in order for them to get close enough for this reaction to occur. So you may know that people are interested in making the same process that powers the sun process electrical generators here on Earth. And the hard part is you have to have hydrogen gas that is extremely hot. And of course, how do you contain something that's extremely hot? And there are a couple of solutions. Again, if you watch Star Trek, you've seen them both in action, right? You can have a magnetic bottle that doesn't actually have physical walls, just has magnetic fields as walls. That's one way of confining very hot stuff. And the other way is not to bother, right? You can just have basically a small hydrogen bomb explosion. Scale the whole thing down so it doesn't blow up your reactor, but do thousands of them per second, and you can have a conversion. So that goes under the name of controlled thermonuclear fusion. Questions? Well, the main topic today, and it's a question that usually occurs on exams, is why the sun doesn't explode. And you can see kind of the lineup. I'm trying to try to convince you that things usually explode, that explosion is what you should consider the usual case. But chances are you haven't seen anything explode today, so I also have to explain why explosions seem rare. And then I have to explain what saves the sun, why the sun doesn't explode. And the answer turns out to be a mathematical theorem that's called the Virial theorem. And like any theorem, it has an if part and a then part. And it turns out that the if part is exactly specifies what the sun is doing, and the then part is exactly what's required to keep it from exploding. Okay, so why do things usually explode? Well, let's start off by thinking about what things you do hear about that explode. Right, so we're coming into heating season, and not uncommonly you hear about natural gas explosions. Another thing that you not uncommonly hear about exploding are silos. So what goes on in these things that seems to be special, but as I claim is not actually special, that makes these guys explode? So you know that, you know, the typical natural gas explosion is you have a leak of natural gas in your room. So the natural gas inside the pipe isn't a problem, and the air in your room isn't a problem, and having them come together inside your furnace isn't a problem. What is a problem is if you get a room in which we have an even mix of the natural gas, which is mostly methane, and the oxygen. So if we have a homogeneous mixture of natural gas and oxygen, and again, that's not how your furnace works, right? Your furnace has a vent in which we have pure natural gas And then we have a flame with oxygen on the outside. So we never have an even mixture. Inside the tube, we just have natural gas and no oxygen. Outside the flame, we just have oxygen and no natural gas. But if we get an even mixture, that's where the problem is going to occur. And the problem goes under the name of positive feedback. Now let's talk about this term feedback, because if you've ever attended any sort of concert, you know about positive feedback. The story is that you've got a microphone, and you've got an amplifier, and you've got a speaker, and some random noise is picked up by the microphone, and it's amplified by the speaker, which is picked up by the microphone, and we get a vicious cycle in which very soon, the amplifier is producing its maximum squeal power into the speaker, and the speaker's output is being picked up by the microphone. So positive feedback is a case where a little bit gives more, and it produces this sort of vicious cycle that produces the squeal at the concert. So we've got the same sort of thing happening with our chemical reactions, in kind of a subtle sense. So in order to have a chemical reaction, what we have to have are collisions. Right? Somehow the methane and the oxygen have to get into close proximity. They have to collide. If they collide, then we can have a reaction. Right? In particular, the methane can go to carbon dioxide and water, which is a lower energy state. And of course, if we have a reaction, then we're going to have a release of energy. And if we have a release of energy, what's going to happen is the gas is going to get hotter. And we know what temperature is. It's kinetic energy of the atom. So if the gas is hotter, that means the atoms are going to be moving faster, so we're going to get more collisions per second, which is exactly what we need to have more reactions per second, more energy release per second, temperature getting even hotter, and so it goes. So the tiniest spark can start this reaction going, and then it can propagate out until all of the material is burned in a small fraction of a second. Okay, in the case of a flame, we don't have to worry about it because it can't propagate out, right? Inside the tube, there's no oxygen to burn. Outside the tube, there's no methane to burn. The only place that we can have collisions and reactions is in a very limited region of space, which can't expand. So the homogeneous mixture of stuff and the spark, right, because it takes some initial energy in order to get the thing going, those are the things that are required, but once we have those initial conditions, we have exactly what we need to have this sort of positive feedback cycle. Right? So if somehow you're able to put this system in a soundproof room, if there is no initial sound, then the system is stable. But as soon as a little bit of sound happens, same thing as a little bit of spark happening, then we have the cycle starting to burn the whole thing. Okay. So what's going on in silos? Well, I mean, it sounds like pretty crazy stuff. The explosive stuff is often just flour. And you don't think of flour as being very explosive, right? If you're baking bread, you don't worry about the bread exploding. But the difference between the silo, typically when it's turned on, is there's a lot of flour in the air. And we have then a homogeneous mixture of something that is burnable, namely flour and air, and we can have exactly the same sort of positive feedback. As long as the flour is in a lump in your measuring cup, you don't have to worry about it because inside the flour there's no oxygen, inside the air there's no flour, and so we can only have burning on a limited range of material. Okay, so homogeneous mixture of stuff and a spark and the existence of this positive feedback loop is what's required, is all that's required for an explosion. There's nothing unnatural about explosions. So the reason that we don't have explosions commonly around here, of course, is that we try and make sure that the two components that are required are kept in separate containers. And as long as the flour is in a bag and not thrown up in the air in the room, everything is safe. So we keep the components separate. Chances are, if the components can't be separated, they already would have exploded right over at the history of the Earth. So those two things, the fact that if they can explode, they already did, and the fact that we try and keep the components separate is what's going on for Earth-based stuff. Okay, but notice that we haven't solved the sun, because the sun doesn't have two components. It's just got hydrogen. And there's no way you can separate the hydrogen from the hydrogen. And the spark already exists, right? We know that the sun is burning. So obviously the conditions inside the sun have the necessary reaction kinetic energy in order to make the reaction go. So we have the spark and we have a homogeneous mixture. And even though we're talking about nuclear reactions as opposed to chemical reactions, it's exactly the same story. In order to make those reactions go, we needed collisions. Collisions are going to release energy. Energy is going to make the thing hotter. We're going to get more collisions per second. There doesn't seem to be any good reason why the sun doesn't explode. Okay, but I mean, it's hard to imagine. I mean, the sun rising tomorrow is kind of the definition of the most likely thing possible. So it's hard to see how this question is at all a problem. But I hope you see it is a problem. The sun is an explosive mixture, and it's hot. And incidentally, some stars do explode. Right? There's currently an exploding star in M101 that I've been taking pictures of. But it's rare. It's actually the first exploding star I've seen. So why? Well, it turns out that this, which is, I think, the most obvious thing possible, is the step that is going to be broken. So it turns out that for the sun, if you were to, you know, fire a phaser beam at the sun, the result would not be that the sun would get hotter. It would get colder. That seems incredible. So if you put the sun in the oven, it doesn't get hot, it gets cold. It gets cold. Yeah, you throw an iceberg.
Yeah, well, I'm saying it's because it's already hotter than the oven.
No, it has nothing to do with the fact that it's hotter. So you dump an iceberg in the sun, and the sun gets hotter, not colder. So it's the reverse of everything you've ever experienced, right? You're used to putting a pan of water on the stove, and you turn on the burner, and the water gets hot. So with the sun, that's not the case. If you were to put the sun on a burner, turn on the heat, it would get colder, not hotter. So this is a very surprising statement. So this is the statement of the Virial Theorem. So the Virial Theorem, it's not tremendously difficult to prove, but we're not going to prove it in this class. And like any theorem, it has an if part and a then part. So the if part is if you're made of a normal gas and you're held together by gravity, and that certainly defines the sun. The sun is gaseous all the way down, and it's held together by gravity. Then if you add energy to the sun, the temperature goes down, not up. And if you remove energy from the sun, the temperature goes up, not down. So I don't know, this should seem kind of incredible. How can it be? Well, the first thing you should remember is energy is conserved. So if I add energy, And you remember that temperature is a measurement of the kinetic energy. And the kinetic energy goes down. The only thing that is possible is that the potential energy goes up. So it must be that I add one unit of energy and maybe I take away one unit of kinetic energy, but then I must get 2 units of potential energy, so it still all adds up. Right, so one piece of energy is kinetic energy and temperature is a measurement of it. If I add energy and the kinetic energy goes down, the potential energy must go way up to overbalance the loss of kinetic energy. And of course, for something that's held together by gravity, the way you make the potential energy go up is by raising it up. So what this must mean is expansion. If I fire my phaser into the sun and there's less kinetic energy of the atoms that make up the sun, it must be that the sun has expanded. And then it kind of makes some sense, I hope, because if you've ever let the air out of your bike tires, you know that the air that comes out is cooler than it would be normal. Expanding air cools it down, compressing it tends to heat it up. So that must be kind of what's behind it. Well, the Virial Theorem turns out to be lots of things in astronomy are hard to prove. It turns out the Virial Theorem is not one of them. It's not super hard to prove. With a little bit of work, we could prove it. But instead of proving it, let's kind of take a look at an example. So instead of thinking about atoms in the sun moving around at high speed, like the atoms in this room are moving around at high speed, let's think about something that's orbiting the sun or the earth. It kind of doesn't matter which. What is the consequence of adding energy to this orbiting spacecraft? So if it's going around this way and we fire the rocket engines that way, that's exactly what would be required in order to add energy to the system. But if you think about what happens is that it's just going to go to a larger orbit. It's just going to expand its orbit. And the moon is going slower than the spacecraft are, right? It takes the moon 30 days to go around the Earth. It takes the space station 90 minutes to go around the Earth. So it's going to end up moving slower just because it's expanded. So if we add energy to this orbiting particle, the result is that it goes to a larger orbit, but in fact slows down. And while here we're thinking about spacecraft as opposed to atoms, the same thing is true of atoms. If we add energy to atoms that are inside the sun, they're going to actually just go to greater distances from the center of the sun and end up moving slower as a result. And it works in reverse. If you fire your retro rockets, if you take energy away from this orbiting particle, the result is that it's going to have an orbit that's closer to the Earth. And orbits close to the Earth are going around faster. So we remove energy, we get more kinetic energy. And the reason we're getting more kinetic energy is we've got less potential energy, right? It has fallen. I don't know, are you convinced? It's not. Say again? So presumably if you hit it hard enough, it'll have an escape velocity, right? So, but that's not what we're talking about. If we add a little bit of energy, it goes up and slows. Take a little bit of energy away, it goes down and speeds. And while here we're thinking about spacecraft and rocket engines, it's no different for the atoms that make up the sun. They are also gravitationally bound to the sun, and they're essentially orbiting. If you add energy to them, they expand and they slow down, which is a result of temperature. Okay, so anything that's held together by gravity and made of a normal gas, turns out, has to have those properties. Right, so this piece of chalk is not made of a normal gas and it's not held together by gravity, so if I put it in the oven, it heats up. A balloon, a hydrogen balloon, it's made out of a normal gas, but it's not held together by gravity. It's held together by that elastic band. So if I put it in the oven, it gets hot.
Right? Hmm? So this basically only applies to like stars?
Pretty much, because pretty much a definition of a star is that it's made of a gas and held together by gravity. You might think about things like Jupiter, which is also made of a gas, but we don't call it as a star. And it turns out that what's the case of Jupiter is that, I mean, to say a normal gas is to say that there's another type of gas that isn't normal. And those are called degenerate gases. And it turns out that that's what's going on in the case of Jupiter. But that should worry you a little bit, right? Because if this theorem doesn't apply, then explosion is possible. So why doesn't Jupiter explode? It's cold. Yeah. So I say it's cold. It's like 50,000 degrees hot at its core, but we need millions of degrees in order to run these nuclear reactions. So compared to what's required, it's a little bit cold.
And is it the same for Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune?
Yeah. So Uranus and Neptune are more liquid than gaseous. Yeah, so there's still no solid as you go all the way down, but usually we wouldn't call those guys gas giants. We call them liquid giants. But yeah, true of Jupiter too. If you get just maybe 10 times bigger than Jupiter, then it turns out they kind of simultaneously it's made out of a normal gas and it starts to shine like a star. So the exploding star I was studying, it must have been made of a degenerate gas, which caused it to explode. So what we'll be studying in the next month is how that's possible, how a star can go from being made of a normal gas to a degenerate gas, and then as a result, explode. But as long as the sun is made out of a normal gas, which is not all of its lifetime, but most of it, then it's safe. It will rise tomorrow. But if it starts to be made out of a degenerate gas, then we should get worried. Okay, questions?
Do we have to know about degenerate gases?
So I'm going to hold off giving you a definition of degenerate gas until we actually reach one. Okay. But let me comment that obviously they're in some sense rare, but they're not super rare.
So you said you've been observing an exploding star. How does that mean that it takes a long time for something that large to explode? Like, where you said,
so explosions of stars typically take very short periods of time. So in order for this total room to explode, what we have to have is a shock wave that's traveling at the speed of sound travel through that room. And you know, shock waves are going to travel at 300 meters a second. You know, maybe it's 10 meters big. So in a 30th of a second, that room is gone. Now, stars are a lot physically bigger, and the speed of sound is faster in stars, but we're still talking about very short periods of time, just a few seconds in order for a star to explode. But once the star has exploded, it's still going to be shining and expanding for a good period of time. So the explosion occurred about 50 days ago, and the light from that explosion, the material expanding away from that explosive center, all that's continuing. So right now it's only about a quarter as bright as it was originally. And over the next 100 days, it'll go to invisibility. More questions? During the brief time when it is shining, it'll shine as bright as a galaxy by itself. So it shines with the brightness of more than a billion stars. More questions? Okay, so that's all that it will be on our exam, but we're certainly not done talking about the sun. So, I mean, as always, vocabulary's a requirement for this course. So, what are the various names for the interior parts of the sun? And the surface of the sun now, I have to put surface in quotes because there is no surface, right? If I drop a rock on the sun and if it didn't burn up, it would go right to the center. It's gaseous all the way down. What we see as an edge of the sun, right? So we see not sun and sun. There seems to be an edge to the sun. What that edge really is just where the sun goes opaque. So opaque means that it absorbs light. Light can't get through it. So why does the sun become opaque? What's the difference between the parts of the sun that are transparent and the parts of the sun that are opaque? Well, as I've said before, the sun and basically everything in the universe is mostly hydrogen and helium. And, you know, you've looked at hydrogen balloons and helium balloons. Those are transparent. So how is it that hydrogen and helium can become opaque? And the answer is the ions. Right? At high enough temperature, these guys will break apart and they'll become hydrogen and helium, not the way we're used to seeing it. And it turns out that an ion of hydrogen is particularly absorbing of light. And it's really kind of a tricky story. So if you've taken chemistry, you're probably a lot used to positive hydrogen ions, where hydrogen has lost an electron. Right? That's what's behind the pH. The H of pH is the concentration of positively charged hydrogen ions. But it turns out that the reason that the sun is getting opaque is actually because of a negative hydrogen ion. So that's one proton orbited by two electrons. And by happenstance, that turns out to be fairly opaque. So that transition is just where the temperature is right to have the formation of the negative hydrogen ion. So what we see as features on the sun, as often or not, are not differences in composition, right? When you look at a cloud, you know you're looking at stuff that has a different chemical composition than typical air. But when we look at the sun, what we're seeing is not so much differences in composition, but differences in temperature. Because it's all hydrogen or helium. Some of it may be ionized hydrogen, but it's all hydrogen and helium at its core. And so what we're seeing here in the so-called surface features of the sun are simply different temperatures, mostly. So the most obvious features, and the ones that Galileo is usually credited with discovering, but in fact the Chinese discovered many centuries before Galileo, are dark spots in the atmosphere of the sun, which are called sunspots. And what's going on is the sunspots look dark just because they're cool. And I better put cool in quotes because the sunspots are hotter than anything you've ever seen. So it turns out that the sunspots are hotter than the filaments that are inside those incandescent light bulbs, maybe twice as hot. But the sun is three times as hot as those incandescent filaments. So relative to the very bright sun, the slightly cooler sunspots look black, right? But if I were to bring a piece of sunspot into this room, it would be shining brighter than the filaments in those bulbs, right? So it really is bright. It's only, relatively speaking, that it looks dark. Now this should bother you a little bit. So maybe I should comment a little bit more. These sunspots have relatively long lifetimes, weeks, months, something like that. Turns out that the sun rotates on its axis in about a month. So we can see a sunspot this month, and then we can see that it's gone all the way around the sun. Now it's back to us again. So they have relatively long lifetimes, but the sun is a very turbulent place. The outer parts of the sun are like the water in your pan that is boiling. It's a lot hotter inside the sun than it is at the outside of the sun, so we have hot material rising, cool material falling, which is called convection. And just as that stirs the boiling water on the stovetop, it should stir the outer part of the sun. But somehow or other, these sunspots are sequestered from that boiling material so that they're not going to be mixed up with the rest of the hot surface of the sun and therefore disappear. So how is it that in the midst of this, you know, hurricane of motion, these sunspots are not partaking in all of that up and down motion that defines the sun? Well, so a moment ago I reminded you that one way that people have talked about simulating the sun on Earth is by using magnetic fields to confine the very hot material, the plasma. Right? So the various engineers, Scotty and Geordi on Star Trek, occasionally have done the same thing. So magnetic fields are able to affect, not hydrogen gas, right? So if you take your hydrogen balloon and apply a magnet to it, it doesn't do anything to it. But to ionized gas, gas that actually has an electrical charge, magnetic fields have an effect on it. And it turns out that the sun has a much stronger magnetic field than the Earth does. And what's going on here with this sunspot, it's kind of like the good hands folks. So we have a magnetic field that is sequestering the material that's making up the sunspot, isolating it from all the motion that's going on outside. And so the sunspot material is going to cool off and start to look dark. So it's really the magnetic field that is causing the sunspot sort of behavior. And it's not something that is fundamentally true of the material happens to be cool because it's being separated by the magnetic field. It's not that the cool material is existing primarily on its own. So this fact that magnetic fields play a big role in the dynamics of the atmosphere of the sun is going to be involved in all of these sorts of phenomena, these so-called surface features of the sun. So this is not a particularly great picture of a prominence. I don't know if I have a better picture of a prominence. Some of you saw one pegged to the wall. Yeah, this is a slightly better one. So prominences are these big loops of material that is suspended. This is tons of material that is suspended above the surface of the sun. And what's happening here is we have a magnetic field that is holding this material up. And again, these are not dynamic sorts of events. These prominences can last weeks, relatively long periods of time, having this incandescent material suspended in the atmosphere of the sun.
Is that an exaggeration?
That's an exaggeration, yeah. So that they would typically be, but okay, so what I didn't like about this picture is there is nothing that looks loopy about that to me. And they actually do look usually loopy, but they look like really, you know, kind of like my fingernail more, maybe even my little pinky nail sticking above the surface of the sun. But remember, the sun is huge, so that little pinky is actually way bigger than the Earth is. Things that look that big are often flares. So flares are, I'm going to call it an explosion on the surface of the sun, but it kind of gives you the wrong feeling because I've defined an explosion as a release of kind of chemical energy or nuclear energy. But in this case, the flare is a result of a release of magnetic energy. So what we have is a huge release of magnetic energy, which flings some of the solar material out, and this material can actually end up, you know, moving past the Earth eventually. So that's one of the things that's responsible for the northern lights, right? So we have here we have the stuff that's being thrown off from the sun. Here's the Earth. These are the magnetic field lines of the Earth. And you know that we have these phenomena of northern lights where we see lights in the sky, particularly at night. One of the things that you should recognize is it turns out that those lights are constantly present. So here we have the constantly present ring of northern lights that surrounds the Earth's North Pole. And what's actually special about when we see northern lights is this constantly present ring expands down to include Minnesota. So there are northern lights that are constantly going on 24 hours a day in a circle around the North Pole. When we have this sort of explosion on the surface of the sun and solar wind material sweeps by the Earth, what the net effect is that it affects the Earth's magnetic field to bring out this band of northern lights material. And I show this picture, but I'm not actually sure it's of the Earth, because northern lights, the equivalent of northern lights, occur all the time in all the planets, right? So here's a planet that I know isn't the Earth, right? It's Saturn. And these are the northern lights that are visible on Saturn. Okay, so we've got sunspots, we've got prominences, we've got flares, we've got granules. And spicules. So probably the granules are the easiest thing to explain. So you remember I said that the material in the outer part of the sun is literally boiling. So we have hot material that is rising and we have cool material that is falling. So the surface of the sun should be spotted with hot spots and cool spots as the top of those regions that have hot material rising and cool material falling. So the granules are those the top part of one of these convection cells that reaches inside, but not all the way to the sun, not all the way to the center of the sun, as we'll talk about. And spicules, people don't really understand exactly what's going on here, but the spicules look kind of like grass. There'd be zillions of these little cone-shaped projections of material into the atmosphere of the sun, and they're clearly magnetic in origin. Here's what's called a filament. And a filament is actually just a prominence seen not, so you can only really notice the prominences when they're at the limb of the sun. But if we were where that is, we would see this material that's obstructing our view of the surface, and it would look like a filament.
Is granule a hotter?
Say again? Yes, so the visible granule would be the hotter part. So sometimes they talk about granulation, which is this whole pattern of light and dark surfaces. Okay, so those are named features on the surface of the sun. How about named features inside of the sun? So I said that there is a region of the sun that is literally boiling, where we have hot material rising and cool material falling. It turns out that that region doesn't extend all the way to the core. So inside of the sun, deep inside the sun, the material is still. It's not moving. So what's happening here is we have light that is flowing through still air. And in this outer region is where we have the air actually, I use air, but of course it's hydrogen and helium. This is where the air is actually in motion, in the circular motion of hot stuff rising and cool stuff falling. So this region where we have convection is called the convection area. This region where we have light that's flowing through still material, that's the radiation zone. And we distinguish the region that is hot enough to have thermonuclear reactions going as the core. Okay, so there are no the surface of the sun is like 6,000 degrees hot, and that's not hot enough to get those protons to get pushed together. The only place it's hot enough to get these reactions to go is close to the center of the sun, which is 15, 16 million degrees hot. Okay, so core, where thermonuclear reactions go, radiation zone, where light is flowing past still material, convection zone, where we have the material, hot material rising, cool material falling. Okay, so how about if we move above the surface of the sun, so-called? So if we move above the surface of the sun, here's incidentally kind of another picture, a little bit more colorful picture of these same things. If we move above the surface of the sun, well, let me back up one step. So kind of no surprise, it's hottest at the center of the sun. As we move out, it gets cooler and cooler and cooler, right? As we get away from the furnace, it's going cooler and cooler and cooler. So where we have the so-called surface of the sun, outside of that is where it's cool enough so that we don't have these negative hydrogen atoms, so the atmosphere looks transparent. Here is where we have those negative hydrogen atoms, so the atmosphere looks opaque, and that's this boundary line. So it's getting cooler, cooler, and cooler as we're going out from the sun, and then we've got a surprise. It starts to get hot. And at first it starts to get hot relatively slowly. That's what's called the chromosphere. And then it gets hot very suddenly and very hugely, and that's what's called the corona. Right, so here's the chromosphere. The surface, so-called surface of the sun is what's called the photosphere, and this very hot, right, 2 million degrees hot, outer atmosphere of the sun is the corona. And I said that material is kind of spewed off from the sun, and that's the solar wind that would be beyond the corona. Okay. So we have another puzzle here that needs to be explained, and that is that, I mean, people think obviously if you're close to the sun, it's going to be very hot, but you can't be hotter than what's heating you. No, so for a flame, we have actually energy release, and that's the main determinant of temperature. There's no energy release here, right? The only energy release is occurring here. This is just energy flow. And here we have a case where we have the corona at 2 million degrees, and it seems to be hotter than what you would guess is heating it, namely the surface of the sun, which is only 6,000 degrees hot. So is it possible to heat something hotter than what's doing the heating? And it turns out that's another statement of the second law of thermodynamics. No, it's not. You can never heat something hotter than what's doing the heating. So that means that this thing, the corona, can't be heated by what it seems to be heated by, namely the photosphere. It must be heated by something that's at least 2 million degrees hot. And what's 2 million degrees hot is buried deep inside the sun. So how that energy gets out is a good question to be answered Friday, probably. Okay, so I hope I'll see lots of you tonight here at 8.